Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, crazy martinis for you as usual. And yesterday in the Good Martini, we talked about some positive developments, it would seem, in the polling data for the 2014 U.S. Senate race in Louisiana. We do state politics once again today in the Good Martini, but moving up to Pennsylvania, this one not so much focusing on any specific race for 2014 or beyond, but just the fact that, as Jim has pointed out in the campaign spot in the Morning Jolt today, that the Democrats in Pennsylvania are very much split on the issue of fracking. You've got the Reagan Democrat types, you know, the people who actually like new jobs and new growth coming into the state, and others who are convinced that any sort of encouragement of fracking will lead to environmental calamity. So, Jim, it's kind of fun to watch the Democrats fighting over this. The bad news potentially is that, you know, the Democrats are going to get positive results, at least those of which are embracing fracking. But the good news is, of course, that even if they do, that's good because jobs and economic development will occur.
Yeah, I mean, this definitely is a fight between, you might say, the boutique liberals and the more working class, union-dominated portions of the Democratic Party. It's kind of surprising. You look back at how well Democrats have managed to paper this over during much of the fracking boom that's going on here. If you ask a Green, they would tell you that Obama has totally been absent without leave on this issue and that he's really been a big disappointment. This terrible fracking revolution that's creating all these jobs across the country is something that he won't lift a finger against. But if you ask people in that industry that actually say, actually, the administration's been a pain in the tuchus, and they keep kicking the can down the road on EPA regulation, and there's all these fears of kind of backdoor regulations to these sorts of things. Where this is really coming to a head is in Pennsylvania, which obviously has had a whole bunch of success. You know, the Marcellus Shale deposits are basically where they're having enormous natural gas and success in this, creating jobs mostly in the north and west of the state, basically almost everywhere except Philadelphia. So unsurprisingly, there are a whole bunch of those who are not employed in this field who think that this is a terrible thing because it's going to poison all the water and it's going to cause earthquakes and cause giant explosions and all that stuff. But what's kind of intriguing is, you know, the state Democratic Party decided its committee had a vote on this, and so the vote was 115-81 to call for a moratorium on fracking, which, of course, would instantly get rid of tens of thousands of jobs. That's almost split down the middle, and so you've got fairly big-name figures on both sides of the state party really kind of going at each other, calling it short-sighted, saying they're dumbfounded by this. And so we on the right, who pretty much think that as long as you're doing it safely, fracking is a hunky-dory way to generate American energy independence and create oil and natural gas, create jobs in communities that have really needed them for a really long time. We see this as almost entirely upside. Greg, we have a very important role in this fight, and that fight is to make it as painful as possible for all the Democrats involved. While hopefully the pro-fracking Democrats end up winning, not only is this going to be probably going to be an issue on 2014, because, you know, the environmentalists, this is their make or break issue. This is not an area where they give anybody any wiggle room. They're going to want an anti-fracking Democrat on the presidential nominee to be the Democratic presidential nominee in 2016. So very curious to watch Hillary on this, very curious to watch other big name Democrats. I know Cuomo had pushed hard against this and put in a moratorium in New York State. As I said, most of the, let's say the San Francisco liberals were big on this. But look, this is such an economic boom that what you might call the Terry McAuliffe liberals, the exceptionally wealthy business community Democrats who are, you know, really big fans of crony capitalism, they don't want this to be shut down at all. So we're looking for some really big, fun fights within the Democratic Party on this. And like I said, we really should be doing everything we possibly can to frackingly remove all the salt to put it right into their wounds over this fight. So,
all right, on to martini number two now, and the bad martini over to Egypt. And that's this fight over what to do with aid to Egypt. For some reason, everybody was hunky-dory with aid to the Muslim Brotherhood, but now that the military has responded to the popular will of the people and removed the Muslim Brotherhood and put down their insurgent attacks, that's some reason that's not such a good idea. The only reason, Jim, that this needs to be addressed is because there is a U.S. law that says if there's a coup, which obviously this was, that aid is cut off, so there would need to be some sort of congressional attention to this. But what do you make of not only this hand-wringing on both sides of the aisle, but also the administration now in the last 24 hours, on one hand, through Senator Leahy, suggesting that aid has secretly been cut off to the military, but now the administration saying, oh, no, that decision hasn't been made yet. Not sure everybody's on the same page here.
You know, this is one of the biggest, messiest hashes to be made of almost any policy in the world, because the law is pretty clear on this, that if there's a military coup, the U.S. is not supposed to send foreign aid. Now, I am one of those guys who has not been a big fan of our aid to Egypt for a really long time. I went there back in 2003 and saw lots of anti-American stuff in the press over there. And my attitude was, look, if we're giving you $1 billion a year, then you don't get to talk about how terrible we are. Or we won't give you $1 billion a year. They're being a bunch of ingrates for all this. So I've wanted to see this aid get cut down or at least reevaluated for a really, really long time. Now, if you're going to say that, look, this aid is one of the few things that gives us leverage over the Egyptian government. If we cut this off, we lose all of our contact. I can see the argument that cutting off U.S. aid could make a bad situation worse. Except the administration doesn't really want to come out and do this. They actually are just kind of being very quiet on this. And they keep saying, well, we're reviewing it. Well, we're reviewing it. And so as Kevin Williamson had pointed out, that like, look, this is one of those things where the law is pretty clear. And so the administration's attitude is, well, look, we're just going to pretend we didn't see a coup. You know, there wasn't really a coup. It wasn't technically a coup. We're still reviewing it, yada, yada, yada. So which basically says to the world either that we're unbelievably stupid, that we can't recognize something that's happening right before us, or that we're liars, that we'll say a coup did not happen when everybody in the whole world watched a coup happen. And to me, this is the exact opposite of what you're supposed to be doing in foreign policy, which is, look, be clear, be direct, let everyone know what you stand for. And if you believe, I am willing to be persuaded that standing with the Egyptian military that is currently, shooting people in the streets in Cairo and other places in Egypt is better than having the Muslim Brotherhood in charge, because they will actually be even bloodier. I'm willing to recognize the argument that maybe they are the lesser of two evils in this situation. But I think we should be clear about it. And so a whole bunch of people have been calling for the U.S. to cut off its aid. And now apparently we're kind of sort of reducing part of our economic aid, but we're keeping the military aid intact or something. But then there was a second report that came out yesterday that said actually the U.S. has secretly cut off its military aid. Now, what I don't get is here you are doing what a lot of people would think is the right thing, but the Obama administration seems to not want anyone to know that they're doing the right thing, which says something about this administration, that even, the old joke about a blind squirrel can find an acorn once in a while, or a broken clock can be right twice a day. The Obama administration gets something right, and then they don't want the world to know about it. Heaven forbid we can't have that happen, because then people might think that we would actually hold our allies to a certain standard of behavior and certain standards of rule of law and things like that. So then, of course, they came out this morning and said that they denied that they had cut off military aid. So right now, military aid to Egypt is in the box with Schrodinger's cat. It is simultaneously, it is continuing and not continuing simultaneously. Nobody knows where we stand. I understand there's an argument for strategic ambiguity in diplomacy, but I'm not really sure it's a good idea to have the United States being completely unclear on what our views on the Egyptian government is in any way, shape, or form.
Well, after all that fun, let's move on to the crazy martini now. And of course, over the last few years, there's been a lot of speculation by some people and consternation in the media about any sort of questioning of President Obama's eligibility to hold the office based on the natural born citizen clause in the Constitution for somebody to be president of the United States. There was plenty of scrutiny over John McCain being born in the Panama Canal Zone, and now the fact that Texas Senator Ted Cruz was actually born in Canada. He was immediately an American citizen because his mother was an American. I believe his father is Cuban. He had a U.S. passport, he says, at the time that he was 18. But after revealing his birth certificate, it's now been reported that he actually has dual citizenship, and now he'll renounce his Canadian citizenship that he never knew he had. And the New York Times is all a Twitter about this, Jim, because now they're trying to figure out if he's eligible to be president. So it's kind of fun to watch this on a number of levels, but kind of crazy at the same time.
In today's Washington Post, Jonathan Capehart, a member of their editorial board, on the one hand, he characterized this as birther nonsense, forcing Senator Ted Cruz to release his birth certificate. And then he says, this is not to be confused with the racist birther nonsense that consumed President Obama's first term. And at first I thought his argument was that the Cruz stuff was sort of okay, but the Obama birtherism, that was really bad and damaging for the country. And I guess Capehart is sufficiently anti-birtherism in both cases. What I'm kind of struck by is almost all these disputes. Look, it's not like we're trying to interpret ancient scrolls on what the law is of what someone is a natural born citizen. There's a direct law there. And the whole reason people cared about this, or the whole reason people should have cared about this with Obama, is that if he had not been born in Hawaii And I do not subscribe to the theory that the Honolulu advertiser was in on the grand conspiracy and he's a Kenyan secret agent and all, you know. There was this vast Moses-like effort to smuggle Obama into this Hawaii. That if he had been born in Kenya, that he would not be a natural-born citizen under U.S. law as it existed in that time. Under the law both then and now, if you're born in the United States, you're hunky-dory. If for Ted Cruz, his mother was American, his father was Cuban, born in Canada, because she had been in the United States for a sufficient number of years, he's a U.S. citizen, he's a natural-born citizen. Ted Cruz, if he chooses to run for president, is hunky-dory. I'm among those, apparently a small, increasingly small minority of people who believes that you should, like, finish a term doing something before you run for president. I'm one of those guys who actually thought George W. Bush was running a little early in his career when he ran in the year 2000. And so, since then, we've had President Barack Obama and now Ted Cruz excitement getting it. So, apparently, it's not too early. I kind of would like to see Ted Cruz do some things, complete a term in the Senate, become the leader of the party in the chamber, but I'm an old fuddy-duddy, Greg. Apparently, none of this stuff matters, and so, you know, this is how we end up having to fight birtherism and things like that.
Well, I've done almost no research on this, but I know there's basically three arguments. One is that you are a citizen regardless of where you are born, as long as you have something in place, like McCain's father was in the military, Cruz's mother was an American, and so forth. Others would say natural-born means you have to be born in the U.S., and then the most extreme version is that both of your parents have to have been born in the U.S., and then you're born in the U.S. as well. So what's the difference between citizen and natural-born citizen?
Everything I went to went straight to the U.S. citizenship laws. I have links up there on Campaign Spot. This is all in U.S. code. This is not some, like I said, some etchings handed down or from Sanskrit or something like that. So I suppose you could argue, there's some people who would argue about what the founder's intent was. But the short version is there's no reason to believe that Ted Cruz is anything less than a natural-born American. When you think about it, you know, would natural-born American qualify for people who are born by cesarean section? or in vitro fertilization? What do we really mean by natural-born, Greg? So it does ban clones from becoming president of the United States. And my favorite theory, if we're going to get into birtherism, Greg, is that I believe that President Barack Obama was born in Hawaii. But the man in the Oval Office is a clone created in Kenya. That's the, you know, I like my conspiracy theories to have kind of a black helicopter sci-fi element to them.
So. Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
Very well played. Well, we'll see who else runs who is going to go under this microscope and see if the New York Times cares this time. Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And please join us again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.